views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Wondered what the journey is to make it to the C-suite? Have you ever wondered why this person succeeded where others have failed? Or when did this person actually make it to the C-suite? Was their journey linear? Go to college, get a job, ascend to the top? Have you ever wondered where did they come from? They're from a small town, big family. These are very important questions to understand where someone came from. But more importantly, and more specifically to this, Executives After Hours, who is this person? What about them is unique? What set of ingredients have they put into their black pot, swirled around, that has equated to some sort of success? This podcast is less about what they do and more about who they are. Every person has a journey. Every person has a story. And it is my job on Executives After Hours to tell you their story. So, grab your sneaks, runnies, tennies, or if you want to call them Betty, put them on, lace them up, go for a walk. Go for a run, go get inspired. This is your Executives After Hours. Hello, welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. If you're checking this out for the very first time, I say thank you. Today on Executives After Hours is Jake Carlson. Jake is a former CFO out of San Jose area. Now, him, his family, are traveling the world, him and his three kids. We dive straight into it. We get into him being a Mormon or LDS, what it's like. Why is there so many successful LDS executives? So, we don't kid around here. It's good stuff. Jake's also the host of Modern Leadership. You can find that on iTunes and all the other major outlets as well. He's a book author, and he's got about four more months left in his little journey. I think he is now in Scotland. No, he's in Rome. So, all right. Stay tuned. Today on Executives After Hours, Jake Carlson. And remember, leave a review. Thank you. See you. Today on Executives After Hours, I have the pleasure to interview Jake Carlson. And Jake, I will let you give my audience the 10,000 foot view of where you're at, what you're doing, and why the hell are we talking?
Well, it's so good to be with you and your audience and to spend this time. You know, one of my favorite things to do is podcasting. I consider myself a podcaster. When people ask me what I do, like, what's your job? Well, not just traveling the world, although that's fun and what I do, but what I do as a job is I'm a deconstruction worker. And when people say, well, a deconstruction worker, I look at people and I help people identify the obstacles that they naturally create in their lives that are stopping them from reaching their goals. And we kind of break down those barriers. We work together to make it to the end. I like to say that we're a society of starters. I help you finish. A little bit about me on the personal side.
I was going to comment on that because we're really good as a society at starting many things. It's the latter. It's the latter that's harder, really.
Yeah. And why is that? I mean, if we think about why people get excited about starting, right? We get on a workout program, or we get on a weight loss program, or we start a podcast. You know, the average podcast only goes 7 episodes. So why do we get excited? And then what happens between getting excited and getting to that ultimate goal? And the reality is life happens. Things happen and we talk ourselves out of it, right? We go to the gym that first day, we work out for an hour, we feel great, we go home, we tell everybody on social media how great we did. The next morning we wake up, we're sore. I don't want to go back to the gym today, I'm sore. So we talk ourselves out of it. Or we start a podcast and we get 7 episodes, it's so exciting, everybody's following us. And then we look at our follower count and we go, oh boy, I don't think I'm getting as many listens as I hoped I would. Maybe this isn't worth my time and investment. And so we stop. And so as a society, we've gotten in this habit of getting excited, having these peaks of emotional excitement, and then having it fall off. And when it falls off, we don't have the skills necessary. We haven't been taught, or we haven't instilled in ourselves the skills necessary to get over that inevitable messy middle to get us to goal completion.
And so from what it sounds like to me is that, you know, one of the things that you really specialize is really a personal coach.
Yes.
And, you know, what you want to do is really help people, to your point, deconstruct what is preventing them from achieving what they want to achieve. But before we go down that path, you know, one of the reasons why it was awesome for you to reach out, or your wife or whoever your PR team is to reach out, is that I'm more interested in who Jake is and how Jake decided to take his family on a year-long sabbatical around the world. So where are you originally from?
Well, I grew up in the Salt Lake City area of Utah, spent a lot of winters there, and decided that I don't like the snow. I don't like the cold. So the first opportunity I had, graduate school, I took off to the beaches of sunny Southern California and fell in love with not having to shovel the sunshine.
So in Salt Lake, did you go to like BYU? Because I was looking on your LinkedIn file and you have a massive following from BYU. So my assumption is that you went there.
Yeah. So I've been around and around when it started with school. Like a lot of people, you start out and then you learn. And as you grow and as you mature, you see different things. And I started out at the local community college and went down that path, decided that I wanted to be a psychiatrist, then decided I didn't want to do that, went to another school, the University of Utah. Got into sociology, decided I didn't want to do that. And then ultimately,
you sound like me.
Ultimately found myself down at BYU, graduating in philosophy with a major, well, I majored in philosophy, but my emphasis was deductive logic and analytic thinking. So aside from boring your audience, that really just tells people that I had more education on the horizon.
I'm going to put this in context for you, just because when I ask this next question, it'll make sense. So I used to work for a company in the Northwest. I'm from Portland originally, and and I worked for a company that was, so this is where I'm making an assumption. You can totally tell me if I'm being a jerk or wrong or whatever,
but
I used to work
for
a company. Yeah, I don't care. Whatever. That's part of the, you know, so for me, my show is about authentic conversation. So I have no real agenda except to understand your path. That's it.
It's awesome.
I worked at this company, and it was 95% Mormon. And for me, it was such an interesting introspective into the Mormon culture. So my assumption is that being from Salt Lake City, you're a Mormon, you went to BYU, Mormon philosophy, so forth and so on. So as you travel, did you do the 2-year mission as well?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting when people hear Salt Lake City, they often make the assumption of Mormon, right? But Salt Lake City itself is actually less than 50% LDS or Mormon. But then when you hear BYU, then you can usually make that assumption because you're about 98% of the students that attend BYU. So that's more of the tip off.
And who's the 2%? Are those the athletes usually?
Yeah, athletes or other wanting to study. You know, they have a great business program, so they'll bring in a lot of international business students.
And so, you know, I'm always curious. I mean, if you're okay talking about this,
absolutely.
You seem like you're You've got to be pretty open if you have a podcast. And podcast is, what was your old podcast that you just closed down?
Family Before Fortune, building the life of your dreams with the people you love.
You can always go to iTunes and check out all of the 117 back issues that Jake has done. I think I got that right, 117.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, 117 went live today. So,
Which was a two-minute snippet.
Yeah, we're right at the end.
Yeah. So, you know, you hear stories of – so let me break it down this way. So here I am in this company, and I'm working with all these Mormons who are, you know, LDS, and I'm labeling kind of – I sound like an asshole already – that are amazing people, like some of the most genuine, kind people that I've ever met. But what always sounds interesting is that there's the group think together and there's the individual think on the side. And I always found it fascinating when I would get them one-on-one, you would get a different side of their personality where if they were in the group mentality. Did you ever see that from that capacity as you were growing up, or is it because you're in it? Is faith still really a big part of your life?
Yeah, so I mean, absolutely, faith is a huge part of my life. And I think you're right on that when you're in it, it's harder to see. And especially when you're in it where you're kind of surrounded by it. So growing up in an area like Salt Lake City, or growing up in going to school at BYU, where you're surrounded by one kind of mentality or one, you know, cohesive faith, you know, you hear, you become part of what you're around, or you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. Well, that's true in life as it is in business. So if you walk out your front door and everybody on your street is one religion or another, you tend to kind of take on some of those qualities. You'll notice that there's a certain cadence to the way that a lot of, you know, in our case here that we're talking about, a lot of Mormons, the way that they talk, that cadence is something they pick up because of their worship service or something like that. And then when you get off onto your own, I don't know that the opinions change so much or the beliefs change so much as just the, you know, the cadence is different or the, you know, the surrounding is different. So it just comes out, maybe sounds a little bit different when you,
but I even think the content was different. Like the content they were willing to talk about as someone who wasn't LDS was, I wouldn't say drastically different, but certainly and marketably different than how they would talk around their peers. Well, because of the, yeah.
The interesting thing about the LDS faith, the Mormon faith, is that it's a very close-knit community. I mean, no matter where you go in the world, we've been all over. We've been in the last 6 months, we've been in the Philippines, in Singapore, in Malaysia. We've been in Thailand. We've been in Myanmar, Cambodia. We've been in Prague. And everywhere we go, we've found a worship service that we can go to. And the interesting thing for me is those worship services, despite all the cultural differences that you see in the countries, when you get into the worship service, it's a very small community. It's very similar across the world. And so because of that, you know, there's some wonderful things about that. Every time we as a family have moved, you know, we moved from Arizona, we moved up to San Jose, we instantly had a community, right? I mean, all we had to do on Sunday morning was go to the church, and all of a sudden we have instant friends, we have instant connections, we have instant networking, and, you know, we have activities for the kids to go through throughout the week. And because there's that tight-knit community that everyone's, you know, joined together and constantly talking together, it becomes, you know, I don't want to make it sound bad, but there becomes this kind of, I don't want to say judgmental, but, you know, yeah, kind of a click in a way where, you know, you want to be a little bit careful how you relate within the group. And then maybe you can kind of let your hair down a little bit when you step outside the group. I would say, though, that that's all personal, right? I don't know that that's necessarily something taught or encouraged, right? I would hope that we could all be genuine and authentic no matter who we're with and where we're at.
But that also speaks to the idea of peer pressure in a different way, right? It speaks to the idea of conformity because you have to conform. And I mean, I've heard stories and seen documentaries where people who've left the church, and I think this is an extreme case, and I don't think it's necessarily the norm, they kind of get ostracized from their family and from communities because they've made a different choice.
Yeah, and that could be very,
you know, I'm not
well
saying it's good or bad. Yeah, right. I don't want to make a judgment call on that. It's what I've seen.
Yeah, and you know, for what it's worth, you know, you have these close-knit communities and then you have outliers, right? And it's easier to relate with someone who has your same beliefs or wants to talk about the same things.
Totally.
You know, if you go to the basketball game, I remember I was a student at graduate student at San Diego State University, and being a BYU alumni from my undergrad and now being a grad student at San Diego State, they were rival schools in sports. And I remember going to sporting events, and of course I was loyal, strong, and true as far as wearing my alumni colors. Well, it didn't endear me to the people around me at different sporting events.
There was no group hugs. There was no.
And regardless of the fact that I was cheering for the same team that they were cheering for, because unless they were playing BYU, I was cheering for San Diego State. But that little bit of, hey, you're different from me, or you see the world different, or you come from a different background, automatically creates that little bit of rift. And that creates an opening for, you know, a little heckling, a little jest. You know, I think most of it was all in fun. But I think that happens in all scenarios, you know, at work, in companies, at churches, that if you have someone that's just a little bit outside the norm, it's a little bit easier to exploit that difference.
Sure. I mean, it's the whole group reference, in-group, out-group. And I just always think it's fascinating because it's such an interesting – there's so many tenets of LDS that I actually think are fascinating. So we've tried to, in my house, have a date night, which has totally gone off the rails since we moved here. But date night, we try to have family night, you know, which are things that probably existed in other religions, but I only learned about it working with predominantly LDS organization. You know, and I found it really fascinating because you can see why the family bond is so strong and you can see why the community is so strong. And, you know, there's tons of benefits to that. You know, is religion for me? That's debatable. And I'm sure my wife would say yes. And I would say maybe. So I think we could have a whole debate with my wife on that conversation. But the tenets that are taught, I think, are what are really important about raising kids and matriculating through life and choices you make and integrity and trust and honesty and things like that.
And so that's, and not to cut you off, but that's things, you know, about religion in general that I like specifically about the Mormon faith. But one thing I like is I say, how do I want my kids to be raised? You know, what are the qualities that I want them to have? I want them to have integrity. I want them to have honesty. I want them to have commitment to what they, you know, if they put out their hand and say, I'm going to do something, that they'll go out and do it. And, you know, regardless of what ultimate faith you choose or whether you choose a faith or spirituality or not, raising your children with a set core beliefs that you can point to and say, you know, mom and dad love each other. We go out every week. Of course, I'm with you. Since we've been on the road, we haven't had a single date. But, you know, or family night where we have an opportunity to come together and either, you know, talk spiritual things or, you know, frankly, we'd spend a lot of time in our family counseling together, looking at, you know, what's coming up this week. What do we have to accomplish? Who's going to handle what role, you know, as the kids are homeschooling, as we go out and see different places in the world?
Well, and I want to like one part about that. So I've been fortunate. So you're traveling the world and you're kind of experiencing it. But as you're traveling, it sounds like at least you're still embedding yourself in the same community where you go with the same core tenets, right?
Yes.
So you go to, so I've lived in Australia for 4 years. I've lived in Japan for a year, obviously the Middle East, which is a unique setting in and of itself, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that you really learn is in Japan, it's a Buddhist philosophy. In Australia, religion is a minute part of their life. I mean, there are groups of people who are definitely Christian, Catholic, LDS. It's there, but it's not a majority of the people. And what you find, though, at least what I have found, is that regardless of the faith, the tenets end up being the same for people who raise their kids, meaning be a good human, be kind to others, be generous, be respectful. Regardless of their faith, the basic tenets across religions that I've experienced, this is Islam as well, it's always the same thing. And so what that really taught me, at least as an individual, is that it's less about faith and more about your own personal philosophy of life, which is embedded from faith. Like I've gotten it from faith and being raised in a house that was Catholic and so forth. But for me, I could care less what faith my child is. And more importantly to me, how they treat other human beings. And I'm sure you would agree with that. If your children said, you know what, I don't want to be LDS, that might break your heart. But if they're good human beings, that's all you can ask for at the end of the day.
Yeah. Ultimately, I think as parents, we want our kids to have all the blessings and benefits that they can receive. And to have that, to do that, they need to be the best people that they can be. And as you were talking about that, I'm reminded of our experience when we were living in Kuala Lumpur. You know, we were outside of town in a place called Setia Alam, and we were in a big high-rise building. And at the base of this building was a park. And every Saturday, the park would just fill, like brimming with people, thousands of people, mostly Muslim people, that would come out and spend time as a family. They would rollerblade. They would ride the little motorcycles. They would blow bubbles. They would, you know, fish in the pond. And it was just an incredibly family-oriented community. And it had nothing to do with my religion versus their religion. It was all about us being parents, wanting our kids to spend time together, wanting them to grow up, see the world, experience different cultures. And so, yeah, I would absolutely agree with that.
And I think that's what's important, right? So, you know, one of the reasons why we moved our kids out here for the next, you know, 4 years probably, was because I was feeling in the U.S. that there was a narrative about a religion that wasn't 100% true. So when I lived in Perth, I met a Muslim who was from this area, ironically, was literally the nicest, kindest. I mean, I couldn't even tell you, like, I felt like he was one step from heaven already, right? So he was an amazing human being. It just kind of made me think that maybe what I know isn't correct. And so after being back in the States and having my children, and the narrative that's currently going on in America isn't the healthiest around that particular religion, I thought it was really important that if my children are going to have a negative or positive attitude towards religion, I'd rather it not be pressed on them. I'd rather them determine it themselves by being in that culture. Now, obviously, moving halfway around the world is a bit extreme to make that point. So there's other layers to that move as well. But I think that's an important and critical step in terms of your children developing their own opinions about faith and culture. So when we go back, they can say, nope, that's not how it is. Right? Like, that's not what we experienced being surrounded by Muslims 24/7. So I think that's amazing that you had that experience. And I think it's super awesome.
Yeah. And so, just to tag on to that just a little bit, when we had our first daughter, we were living in Gilbert, Arizona. And when she first started school, when she went to kindergarten, it was like 92% middle class, you know, upper to middle class white kids. And then after about 3 months of living there, we uprooted the family. We moved to San Jose, California. We put her in the kindergarten class. And in her kindergarten class, there were people from China, from Japan. There were Indians. There was a young kid awesome. In her class that couldn't speak English because he had just immigrated from Russia. And she came home one day. She had walked home from school with this little boy, and she was helping him learn English. He was helping her learn Russian. And I said, this is really what it's about. And having our kids see that there's more to the world than just middle-class white kids for our particular case. And that, you know, when we got into San Jose, which is a tremendous melting pot, the greatest thing for us was for them to experience different cultures, different beliefs, different people, and see that they're all awesome, that they have incredible qualities and a lot to teach us.
Well, as you travel, have you noticed that there's more that binds us together than separates us?
Yeah, you know, I think growing up sometimes in the States, we have blinders on. We think that, you know, USA has got all the smartest people and all the wealthiest people and all the best looking actors and actresses and the most talented people. And then when you get out into some of these areas, you start to realize that there are brilliant people everywhere on this planet. And I think one of the difficult things is that they haven't been given the same opportunities to expand and evolve in those different you know, skills and assets that they have. For example, we were in the Philippines and there were these bright young children. I mean, kids that I think would be, you know, Ivy League kids as they got a little bit older. But because they weren't given the same opportunities, they were growing up to drive taxi cabs or ride pedicabs or do, you know, fishing or something like that, not able to use the skills and the talents that they actually have. And I think as the world continues to evolve, as Facebook spends their time making sure that the world is connected, you know, they're putting satellites everywhere so that even if you're in the remote areas of Africa, you can still get online. I think is that
of
happens,
course,
right? Because they, it's their business model.
Because their life isn't already hard enough that we need Facebook just to make us feel more connected.
But what it is doing, though, is it's showing what else is out there and opportunities. And I think as we flatten the world, we as a whole species, as a whole human race, are going to evolve and grow, and so much more inventions and life-saving talents and medicines are going to come out of this because we're going to tap into the human potential that is across this globe.
So I want to ask you one more question that I always find fascinating because just the outcome of this. And then we'll move off from religion. I really want to talk about your journey and your choice to go take your family around the world.
Sure.
One of the things I always find fascinating about LDS is the two-year mission. Now, I understand the premise of the mission, right? But it's how successful people are after the people in business after the mission. What do you think it is about that 2 years that ends up switching? I've just met so many successful Mormon business men and women.
Yeah.
So what happens?
Well, I think that there's a real growing up process that happens when you're sent away to maybe a foreign country. You know, in my case, I was sent to the Philippines, and this was, you know, 20 years ago, but I was sent to the Philippines. I'm 19 years old. I now have to make choices for myself as far as money, as far as, you know, where, what time I'm going to get up. You know, I'm told this is the rules I have to follow, but ultimately there's nobody babysitting me. I have to grow up and do it myself. And then what do? All day, I spend time talking to people. I develop my communication skills. I learn a different language. And I think that when you compare that to what a lot of 19-year-old young men are doing, you know, a lot of 19-year-old young men are heading off to college and they're joining fraternities and they're spending the 2 years, you know, taking generals in school and learning to party with their friends and learning to be free for the first time away from their parents without the same structure and the same rules that like a mission would have. And then you contrast that with a young man who goes out, he follows rules for a couple of years, he learns to communicate with people, and then he comes back and goes into the schooling system and he's a lot more focused. I think those 2 years, really, it's a growing up process that everybody has to have, whether you're going to have it, you know, at your college or you're going to have it on a, in a foreign country on a mission. You got to grow up during those 2 years. And I think that that LDS missionary kids are forced to grow up a little bit faster because of the responsibilities that they have.
But don't you think part of that, though, in terms of business and tenacity is the fact that you get the door closed in your face so many times and the word no 1,000 times and you're on your feet all day walking or doing whatever your mission states you need to do. But rejection is a huge part of that. Failure is an everyday occurrence. And it teaches you to get up, do it again, regardless, right? So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, Zig Ziglar says that timid salesmen have skinny children. And the best way to overcome that timidity is to have the door shut in your face. You know, that first time that it happens, it stings, it hurts, and it hurts for all of us. You know, the first time that if you're a real estate agent and you make a cold call, or the first time as a Xerox salesman, you go knock on a corporate door and they say no, it stings, it hurts for all of us. But when you go through that 10, 15, 30 times a day for 2 years, you develop this sense of I'm worth, they're not rejecting me. They may not be interested in my message, but I'm still an important person. I'm still doing important things. It's just not for them. And so, yeah, I think that that continued ability to adapt and adjust to rejection does a lot of good for maturing.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right. So what I want to do is we're going to quickly do my what's called I really got to find a different name for this, but we're going to do my fast five. And as I always say, it's neither fast and it's usually longer than five. But there's five random questions and answer them as however you like. And I'll interject and I'm sure it'll just go as long as possible. Then I really want to talk to you about this choice about, you know, writing a book, traveling the world and what you're really trying to accomplish in the long term. So are you ready to do my fast five?
I'm on the edge of my seat.
Don't fall down. All right. Question one. What was your first job ever?
First job ever. Well, my first official job, I was 13 years old, and my dad had a client who was starting a pizza shop right downtown where all the, you know, business folk would come in and buy a slice of pizza. And they needed someone to come in from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. just during that lunch rush and, you know, mop the floors and clean up the bathrooms and break down the boxes. That was my first official job. But I always have worked. You know, I've always done that. And as I was thinking about, you know, as you mentioned that, the thought that came to my mind was, I remember being like 6 or 7 years old and having the opportunity to sell greeting cards door to door, you know, go door to door, sell them to all the neighbors. And if you sold a certain number of them, you got a basketball. And I just remember having this desire, this dream, going door to door, selling cards that nobody wanted to buy because I was just a cute kid with a smile, getting that basketball and the accomplishment of that.
So what is your, you know, I usually ask more about people's family. I totally just got off track, but what does your mom and dad do or did?
So my dad has been a stockbroker for 40 years and mostly specializing in options trading. I worked with him for a couple of years and it was one of the most incredible experiences, taught me so much about the business world and about life. And then my mom is a executive at Hewlett Packard.
Oh, wow. So you come from a family of parents that are strivers, right? They want to excel.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. My parents divorced when I was 12 years old, and my mom has spent a lot of time around the United States. She travels a lot with her work and kind of touches base with us. And then my dad has always been right in the same home, the same job, the same business. So a little different in how they approach it, but both are very high achievers and goal setters and go after it.
Question two, if what animal best describes your management style?
What animal best describes my management style? Boy, this is, now we're getting into some tough questions. So identifying what my management style is.
Sweet Jiminy, if this is a tough question, you're in trouble. So,
well, we're going to have fun, right? My management style is to be very nurturing as far as, like, I like to take younger employees, younger team members under my wing and help mentor them. I'm more of a mentor type of philosophy. I'm not a micromanager and I'm not a, you know, very strict, hard to please type of boss or manager. I'm a, you know, let's work on this together. So what animal works on things together? I don't know. A kangaroo?
I actually thought of a kangaroo, actually, when you were talking and describing it. Yeah. So I'll go with kangaroo. That's what came into my head.
About that.
All right. Question three. What advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
This is something that I wish when that time travel machine comes into existence and I get to go back and tell my 25-year-old self, this is exactly what I'm going to tell him. Jake, go out and do what you dream of doing. Go out and do what you want to do. So much in life, we're told, you know, go to school, follow these rules, be a lawyer, you know, finish law school and do this traditional route. And I don't think in my heart that I'm this traditional route type of guy. So my advice to 25-year-old self, and by the way, if I have a time machine, I'm going back earlier than 25. I'm going back to 18 or 19. And, you know, go out and try things and fail and build on what your failures are. Sometimes you win, sometimes you learn. And at 25, buddy, you got a lot of life left. So go to it.
I think one of the things that I hear when I ask that question, I mean, these are like the only five questions that I really ask consistently, by the way. But what you hear a lot is failure, patience, persistence. Some people talk about, you know, cultivating relationships as something they wish they would have done a better job of versus being super cutthroat trying to get through the top. And it's just always, it's always a fascinating question because you can't go back, right? That's the lesson. Like you can't go back. You are who you are because of what's happened. And if someone who's listening to this is 25, hopefully, you know, it resonates with them. You know, one of my many jobs is I'm actually a professor. So I teach kids all the time, 18 to 21. And I tell them all the time, like, be patient, you know, be focused, follow your dreams. And then they all laugh at me and say, well, my mom wants me to be an accountant. My dad wants me to be a lawyer. I'm like, I always go like, I don't care what your parents want. Like, what do you want? You know, because when you're 30, your parents aren't going to be there. You're going to be by yourself or with a wife or whatever. But yeah, so I always think it's fascinating that particular question.
Well, and I came to the realization, you know, I had been in my career right out of school. I'd been in my career in my early 30s. And
we didn't mention you were also a trained lawyer, so that also goes into the whole thing.
Well, now nobody's listening, but you know, yeah, at 25, I was still in school. But you know, I came to this realization. I'd been working for 10 years. I'd been in the workforce for 10 years, and I wasn't happy. I wasn't doing what I wanted to do. And I came to this realization. You know, I've been working for 10 years. I have at least 30 years left in the workforce. I've only been working for less than a quarter of my life. I can't do this forever. Miserable.
Yeah. I think that way all the time. Like I don't know how I'm 42 this year. I guess I'm going on 43. And I often think about, I still have roughly 20, 25 years left. I have a long way to go till I'm done.
So well, like, and with the advances in medicine, you probably have longer than that.
Do you ever wonder that question? Like, how old is too old?
Well, I often joke to my wife that I want to pass away at 65. And of course, she's horrified by that thought. But, you know, I want to live long enough that I can enjoy life. I can enjoy my kids and my grandkids growing up. But I think that, and maybe this plays into some of my faith in an afterlife and a greater existence later on. But, you know, I don't fear death. I just want to have a great life while I'm here, make my impact, leave my legacy, whatever you want to say. And then I want to go before I become a burden or before I have real health problems that I have to deal with.
Yeah, I always say, like, if I get to 90, man, and something goes wrong, let me go. Like, yeah. I've had a good life. Like, yeah. I can't be that productive at 90. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but, like, I feel like changing my depends on a regular basis would not be a pleasurable experience for most people. So let me go. That's kind of my thinking.
Yeah,
all right.
I'm with you.
Question four. At your funeral, while you're watching from above or beside or wherever, what do you want people to say about you?
Yeah, and of course, hopefully I'm not 65, right? Hopefully I'm closer to 90 at this point. I look over my life and I want people, this is what I want them to say. This guy loved his wife. This guy loved his kids. There was never a doubt. There was never a question. He made decisions in his life that were ups. He made decisions in his life that were down. But everything he did for his family because of love.
And that, right? Like, that's the fundamental of every, I don't know. I just feel like I've asked people that question and they say, oh, that I was super successful or wealthy or whatever. But I think to myself, you can't take any of that to your grave. Right. So it doesn't really matter. All right. Question five of the not fast five.
The unforgettable five.
Or maybe forgettable. Depends on the answers and the questions. Of all the places that you're going to go, right? And you have another, 6 months left on the road?
About four and a half, yeah. We come back in July.
Okay. So far, I guess in the 6 months, what's been the favorite place that you've been to and why?
Well, a lot of this trip so far has been my bucket list. It's been a lot of the places that I wanted to go and that I wanted to see. And you know, one of my bucket list items was to come to Prague at Christmas and see the Christmas villages. But forever in my life, when I was 19, 21, first coming home from the mission that we talked about, my dad came out to the Philippines, picked me up, and we went and toured through Thailand, rode on the elephants and did all that. Then we went over to Vietnam and crawled through the tunnels of Kuchi, and we went to Hong Kong, and I had an incredible experience. Well, when I was on the airplane, I was reading through the magazine. And as we were heading towards Vietnam, and I pointed at a picture and I said, Dad, this is why I've always wanted to go to Vietnam. I want to see this. And he looks at it and he goes, that's in Cambodia. Well, we didn't make it to Cambodia on that trip. So I've always, from that moment on, I've always had it in my heart and in my dream that I want to go to Angkor Wat and I want to see, you know, the old Wats that have the trees growing through them, you know, if you've seen Tomb Raider. And so that was a number one priority on my list. And I got to tell you, it was incredible. It delivered in spades. I loved Cambodia. We had such a great time. And Angkor Wat is so gorgeous. And those temples, the Wats, are just incredible. So I would say that's been probably my favorite spot that we've settled.
Thank you so much for doing Fast Five. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's fun. Fun five.
All right, so now what I want to spend the last 15 minutes on or so is just kind of talking about this journey you're on and the impetus behind it and what you're trying to accomplish. So talk me through this initial conversation with your wife of saying, hey, let's drop everything and go travel the world for a year.
Yeah, well, this is a great story. You're going to love this, but it starts a little bit earlier than that. It starts with the decision to go to law school. And when I went to law school, I had no idea, no plan, no goal to become a lawyer. I actually wanted to just take a couple law classes that would help me in my business career. You know, fast forward 3 years later, I'm taking the bar and all of a sudden I'm a lawyer. And then we find ourselves in San Jose. And San Jose is awesome. We already talked a little bit about the cultural diversity that's there, and it's just an incredible place. But it's also a very busy place. It's a place where husband and wife need to work. I mean, an 1,100 square foot apartment is going to cost you $2,500 a month to rent. I mean, it's incredibly expensive. Mom and dad get up. They drop their kids at daycare. They go to work at 7 a.m. They pick them up on their way home at 7 p.m. You know, they bathe them. They feed them. They throw them into bed. And then the day starts again, you know, and it just keeps in that cycle. And we found ourselves somewhat in that cycle where we were just running, and never feeling like we were getting ahead. And I'd always joke with her, because of my experience of living in the Philippines, that we ought to just sell it all and we ought to just go to the Philippines and live in a Nipa hut on the beach. And we could probably live for the rest of our lives just on the amount of money that we got from selling our stuff. And that was a little facetious and not true. Obviously, it's cheaper to live in the Philippines, but not that cheap. But that was always something that I joked with her throughout the years. Well, one day, I don't know if it was, you know, something in the food or the weather or what was going on, but she came to me and she said, what if we did go travel for a year? She always had the dream to live overseas and to see a different part of the world. What if we did it? Well, I was already on the internet clicking away. How can we do this? Because as soon as she opened the door a crack, I threw
jump.
It open.
You got to jump. Yeah, you just got to jump.
And I often say, you know, if this had been my idea, if I had come to her and said, you know, I'm really serious about this Nipa hut on the beach in the
so
Philippines,
true.
It would have never worked.
Yeah, so true.
Because it was her idea, it has worked. And, you know, I've kind of taken some of the lead in where we are going, some of the places that we've gone. And well, let me put it this way. I did that for the first 6 months and she decided that that was not going to happen again. You are not in charge of choosing where we're going to live and where we're going to visit, because the places that we lived for the first 6 months were Philippines, Thailand, Cambodia, Myanmar, you know, no internet. You can't drink the water out of the faucet. Have to boil the water. You know, completely different language and culture. You know, very big shock for people who haven't lived overseas before. And so she's taken the role of planning the next 6 months, which include, you know, Prague, Rome, Scotland, the UK, London, Paris. And so those places, obviously, a little bit more westernized, better internet, and can stay connected with family, those type of things.
That's awesome. So tell me how you plan this, right? Like, were you both obviously working full time at that point?
No, actually, we were fortunate. She was working. She's a personal trainer, loves personal training. We were fortunate that I was able to do well enough for the family that I could provide. She worked a couple hours a day as a personal, you know, fitness trainer. But other than that, she was a full-time mom, spent all of her time making sure the kids got to gymnastics and soccer practice and golf and everything like that.
It's very similar to our house. My wife's a personal trainer.
Oh, very interesting.
Triathlon coach. So like, you know, so she's busy nowadays doing triathlon coaching classes at a gym here, but also running the kids around while I do my little fun activities. So I can relate totally to that.
Yeah.
Except for I need her money or we're going to be broke. So,
isn't that the truth?
Yeah. So then how did this conversation go with your job? Like, where were you working at this time?
Yeah, so I was the chief operating officer for the Silicon Valley Monterey Bay Council of the Boy Scouts of America. And it was a demanding position and one that, you know, I really enjoyed having the leadership ability, but I didn't see myself doing it long term. And I had often had conversations, not just with my wife, but also with my boss, that, you know, I'm contributing, I'm making a difference. I've been able to take this council, this organization, to a level that we hadn't ever been before. But I don't see myself doing this long term. So the conversation with my boss was actually pretty easy. It just was, hey, you know, we knew there was going to be a time. I've now been here for 6 years. We knew there was going to be a time that I was going to step away and do something else. And that time is going to be in 3 months. Now, that's quite a big notice that I gave. And I don't necessarily recommend that other people who are going to go out and travel the world or quit their job or do something else, that they give that large of a notice. But because of the position I had, and
why do you say that? Why do you say that?
Yeah. Well, the minute you give notice, you really mentally stop working for an organization, and they're not getting the same return on their investment that they were getting before. And, you know, you try hard to stay committed and stay focused. You know, I want to be known as someone with integrity, someone who can be trusted, and so on and so forth. But the reality is, you know,
the mental switch in your brain,
the mental switch in your brain, but also the mental switch in the brain of those that you're working around. See, now I have a team of people who are saying, well, in, you know, 3 months, we're going to get a new boss. And so, you know, all I have to do is bide my time. I don't necessarily need to do this. Or, you know, I have a boss that's, you know, sitting in the management meeting with me, being, you know, at the C level. I was in all the management meetings, and we're creating strategy for the upcoming year, 2 years, and up to 5 years in the strategic plan. And my voice was not as important anymore. And, you know, it was a lot of, well, that was nice of you to say, Jake. But, you know, in 3 months, when somebody else comes in, how are they going to change it? And so I really recommend that you look at more of the 30 to 45 days max when you put in notice, unless you feel like you have a position that's hard to replace and you need to give your organization time to kind of prepare for you leaving.
Yeah, that's an interesting conversation, because in my head, if you're at the right organization, they're going to be, and it sounds like they were supportive, but for me, the biggest thing would be mentally, I would be online every day figuring out where I'm going. Like I would like literally not want to work, because all I'd want to do is read stories about Cambodia and Thailand and stay in this village here. And here's the restriction. Like I would just be totally, I'm a bit obsessive when I'm into something. Like when I want something, it's 110% of my attention. It drives my wife nuts. But like, that's what I would do if I was in that choice. So,
and I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, I was the same way, but I had to commit to saying, look, when I come in to the office, I'm going to be 100% focused, you know, and I'd take an hour lunch break and I'd be on my phone, you know, during lunch break, you know, sir, you know, I mean, at the C level, I can come in and take lunch as long as I want and leave. You know, I mean, it's not a, you know, you clock in at 8 and clock out at 5 or whatever, but you know, I had to kind of mentally put myself into that, you know, hey, I'm clocking in, sure. I'm clocking out, because I need to give, you know, these guys are investing in me, you know, frankly, quite a lot of money to get value out of me. And so I need to make sure I return that value to them.
So the day you handed in your notice, was there any fear on that day of like, is this the right choice? Or were you 100% committed at that point?
I was 100% committed, but I had a huge amount of fear, two huge fears. Number one, I have the utmost respect for the CEO, the guy that I had been working for the last 6 years. He brought me in specially. I had a lot of fear of, you know, the problems that I would cause with him. I didn't want to ruin our relationship. We had a great relationship, and I was afraid that, you know, this would drive a nail between us. By the way, it didn't. The other fear that I had was, you know, when you say goodbye, especially, you know, in my situation where I was saying goodbye to go work for my own business, where, hey, guess what? Now I have to kill what I'm going to eat. You know, I saw the paychecks, you know, boy, I got three more of these babies coming. And then, you know, after that, we've got to feed ourselves, family. And so those were the two big fears, but it was never a doubt in my mind. I am such a planner. I am so analytical in everything that I do that every I was dotted, every T was crossed. I did, you talk about doing research on going to Cambodia. I did research on what bank accounts to open and how to protect our assets while we were overseas and how we could access different things and setting up layers on layers in case we got mugged or in case we got robbed, those kind of things, which by the way, we have been.
Oh, wow. So where, all right, well, I have to jump to that because I only have you about five more minutes. So wait, what happened with this getting robbed and mugged? Where was this?
Yeah, this is probably one of those stories that'll stop a lot of people from traveling. But we were in the Philippines and we were living in a city called Dumaguete. And we had been there for, we had a 28-day Airbnb that we were staying at. And I think that's one thing that you got to be careful of when you're in a third world country or in a not as modernized country, is when you stay at a place for a long time, people start to see your habits and they see your routines. We had been there for about 25 of our 28 days. And during the night, 2 a.m., somebody, they think it was a child or a girl because of how small they had to be to break into our house, broke into the house at 2 a.m., came down the stairs. Now, we were sleeping upstairs, my wife and I and two of my kids. My daughter, who is 8 years old, was sleeping on the couch in the living room downstairs. And I had left my laptop sitting on the kitchen table about 3 feet from her head. And I left it every night with the screen open because I had to do my Microsoft downloads, and the Wi-Fi was so terrible that I would set it up at night and it would download throughout the night. And then I'd get up in the morning, it'd be fine. Well, I think what happened is they came in, or she came in, he came in, saw the laptop, grabbed it, put it into the backpack that was sitting right there, glanced over and saw my daughter asleep 3 feet from them, panicked, and ran out the door. As they ran out the door, one of the things that they took with them, the backpack had all five of our passports in it. And so, imagine me waking up. I get up at 5 a.m. I come down to do some work, and I realize that every piece of office equipment, my whole business, my whole life, just went out the door. And then coming to the realization that every document, travel document that we have, just went out the door with them. Well, thankfully, the criminal was conscientious and returned our passports, believe it or not, put them in a nice stack on our windowsill and delivered them for us. Didn't ring back my laptop, but brought back the passports. So,
that's probably more important at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And the most important was 3 feet from where my computer was, my 8-year-old daughter, untouched, unharmed, and thankfully slept through the whole thing, so doesn't need counseling to our knowledge.
Yeah, true. Sorry. I wasn't trying to downplay that. That's actually more significant. But yeah, I gathered she was okay in the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as you're doing this journey and you're going through, what are you hoping to get out of this?
Well, we had two goals going on this trip. One of them that you mentioned in your decision to go, to the Dubai area, and that is we could save a lot of money starting our business on the road. Believe it or not, it's cheaper to stay in Airbnbs in the Philippines than it is to rent an apartment in San Jose. As surprising as that sounds. And so our first
not
goal,
really.
our first goal was really to extend our runway, to give the business an opportunity to take off. And then the second goal was, my kids are growing up way too fast. I blink and I've got an 11-year-old, and I even tell her every day, I remember when I could hold you in one hand, and now you're 11 and you don't even want to give me a hug anymore. And so we looked at it and said, in order for us to give our kids the opportunity to grow together with each other and to grow together with their parents, to be together, we need to take some intentional time away. And it was perfect timing for us. My daughter was transitioning to middle school. I didn't quite think she was ready for middle school. She was ready academically, but I don't know that she, I don't know, maybe I wasn't ready for her to go to middle school. And then my son was 1 year away from starting kindergarten. So we really had two of our kids that were in transition anyway. So it just made sense to take this year, let them homeschool for a bit, and then come back and be settled when they all can do their transitions at the same time.
So that's one thing for your kids. What was the other thing that you were hoping to get out of this trip? Oh, sorry, you said it. Yeah, the runway and the
runway.
Kids getting
exposed. Yeah, runway and just bonding together as a family.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Mary talks about quite often is, and I, you know, I grew up in a pretty, I wouldn't say shitty house, but definitely there was no huge social bonding between parents, children. I had three older brothers, or two and a half, which is a longer story. There was no bonding. I was the youngest by 5 years. They swam full time. They were gone every morning by five, back at seven. My parents both worked. I was a latchkey kid by third grade, coming home by myself at 2:30, be home by myself till 5:36 every day. And so I kind of grew up in this isolation, I guess, in some ways, every single day. And so for me, I don't think about family bonding, where my wife grew up in a very close family. And so for her, she's always going back to how great is this for us? How much bonding are we doing? And in retrospect, I'm sure I'll see that when I get older. But in the moment, I'm like, I guess. Like, I don't think about it. So I'm like, I guess. But to your point, I mean, this is, if I'm being honest and truly reflective, it really is true, right? Like, you really are giving your kids something that 99% of the kids in the world will never have.
And they probably right? won't There's, understand it until they're older either, right? I mean, when they grow yeah. up and their friends are saying, you know, what did you do at 11? Well, I played soccer on the rec team. What did you do? I was on the swim team. What did you do? I stood on Angkor Wat and watched the sunrise.
And the response will be, Angkor what?
Yeah.
Which, you know, and what's actually the other is, what is also really interesting is that each one of your kids will be impacted differently.
Yeah.
Just because of the age and the maturity. So kind of, you know, bringing this full circle, then what do you, when you get back, where are you going to set up shop for your business?
Yeah, right now we're looking at Arizona. We've always loved Arizona. We like those 120 degree days. And so, you know, we spent a great 6 years there. So I think we're going to go back there and set up shop. Of course, you know, I'm location independent, so I can set up shop anywhere, but we really liked Arizona and the cost of living's perfect for our family. So I think we might head back there. I say might because, you know, we've moved every couple of weeks for the last year. Who knows how antsy we're going to be and where we're going to be. We have our plane ticket home. We've already purchased that because we found a good deal. So we know when we're going home. We're actually flying back into Salt Lake City where we have grandparents and we'll see. And then at that point, we'll have to make a decision. I think we'll head south though.
That's awesome. Now, it's also doing my research on you, you know, noticed you wrote a book. At least hopefully that was the right research. Is yeah. that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Whew. Yeah.
I would have felt like a total smuck if that was wrong.
You know, I'm a huge reader. I love to read, and it's always been a dream of mine to write. And I have plans to write for the rest of my life. Like, that's something that I think you can do forever. And if you like doing it, if you like the grind, because writing a book is a grind, then, you know, that's just a wonderful way to express yourself and move forward. So the first book that I put together, Mini Motivational Stories, is basically, I grew up loving and listening to quotes. And so I took these quotes, 13 of my favorite quotes, actually there's 14 of my favorite quotes, and then wrote stories of my life around those quotes. The next book that I'm writing is going to focus on, you know, what we talked about in the beginning, which is the deconstruction worker.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And when do you think you'll have that one mapped out?
Ooh, I think we're looking at an August release on that one, probably.
Last question I have for you, and then I'm going to let you get off off this ridiculously long call.
it's been fun. No worries.
No, it's awesome. Tell me, in your own words, how do you define happiness?
How do I define happiness? You know, I'm a huge... happiness is, I think, something that we all want to have, we all want to strive for. And I think it's something that we should strive for, we should have in our lives. And to me, happiness is doing what you love with the people you love and making a difference. You know, I told you about my original podcast that just ended today, actually, The Family Before Fortune, which is building the life of your dreams with the people you love. To me, that's happiness. Build the life of your dreams with the people you love.
That's awesome. And just really quickly again, what's the name of your new podcast that launches
today as
soon,
well?
Today. Yeah.
There's actually four episodes up, and I don't know when this episode's going to go live, but it's already launched and in the bag. It's called Modern Leadership with Jake Carlson, and we talk about the leadership superpowers of confidence, accountability, adaptability, problem solving, and inspiration.
Awesome. Well, Jake, thank you so much for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me, be authentic, and have a real conversation.
The pleasure was all mine.
Great. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you, James. I really appreciate it.